Welcome to Salvation by Grace, a broadcast ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. For more information, we invite you to visit our website at www.salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
This is another MP3 disc, brand new MP3 disc available through our website, or for those of you who are here in the room, it's available by walking into the front room and making a copy. If you don't know how to use the CD copying machine that's in the front office, ask somebody who knows. For instance, Pepper over here knows how to do it. And so you can, she knows how to do it.
What's it up, John?
Oh, I'm sorry, did I not tell you? It's just a brand new random disc. It's just... Yes, this is the third MP3 disc on the Gospel of John. And each disc has 24 messages. If you do the math, that lets you know how long we've been in the Gospel of John. We are this morning in the book of John, starting in chapter 18, verse 25. We made mention last week of Peter's denial, but if we're going verse by verse through the book of John, the next thing that occurs after Jesus has been sent to Caiaphas the high priest, the next thing that happens in John's account is Peter's denial. So let's read that real quickly, and we'll also see it as we look at some of the parallel passages in a couple of the other synoptic gospels. Chapter 18, verse 25 of the book of John says, "Now Simon Peter was standing and warming himself. They said therefore to him, 'You are not also one of his disciples, are you?' And he denied it, and he said, 'I am not.' One of the slaves of the high priest, being a relative of the one whose ear Peter cut off, said, 'Did I not see you in the garden with him?' And Peter therefore denied it again." You may recall last week that we saw in verse 17, the first of the three denials. Verse 17 says, "The slave girl therefore who kept the door said to Peter, 'You are not also one of the man's disciples, are you?' And he said, 'I am not.'" Verse 25, you see the second denial. Verse 27, you see the third denial. "And Peter therefore denied it again, and immediately the cock crowed." Now, the reason that John is real emphatic in letting us know that immediately after Peter denied the third time was because at the Last Supper, Peter got all uppity and got all full of himself and said, "If everybody denies you, I'll never leave you." And because it was prophesied that Jesus would die alone, because it was prophesied that his sheep were going to scatter like sheep without a shepherd, Jesus knew that there was no way that that prophecy was going to be upended. Therefore, all of his apostles were going to leave him. So he said to Peter, "You say you're not going to deny me, but I tell you that before the rooster crows this very morning, you'll deny me three separate times." And sure enough, Peter did exactly that. What we see here yet again is Jesus is in absolute, complete, total control in all of these things. I just get worn out watching movies that portray Jesus during this period of his ministry as a poor, weak victim who just didn't see this coming and, you know, struggled against it. And the portrayals of Jesus in most films are just so phenomenally unbiblical. But all of the gospel writers are taking pains to tell us that he's never lost control here. In fact, the next thing that John tells us about is Jesus before Pontius Pilate. And in order to really understand Pontius Pilate and his reaction and his judgment and his discussions and his relationship with Jesus, you have to understand two key things. One is when Pilate says to Jesus, "I have the power to let you go." Jesus says, "You don't have any power here. The only power you have over me is what's been given to you from above." Jesus is clear that men don't have any power over him. To really understand Pontius Pilate, though, you have to turn to the book of Acts. turn real quickly over to Acts 4:26. Keep your finger there in John. Look at Acts 4:26. If you don't know this verse, memorize it. Actually, we need to start at verse 25. Oh, dear. Actually, we need to start at verse 23.
Genesis
1:1. Genesis 1:1. Okay, let's just jump in at verse 24. And when they heard this, they lifted their voices to God with one accord and said, O Lord, it is you who did make the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them, who by the Holy Spirit, through the mouth of our father David, thy servant, did say, Why did the Gentiles rage and the people devise futile things? The kings of the earth took their stand, and the rulers were gathered together against the Lord and against his Christ. For truly in this city there were gathered together against thy holy servant Jesus, whom you did anoint, both Herod, the Jewish leader, and Pontius Pilate, the Roman leader, along with the Gentiles and the people of Israel. And they were gathered together, according to verse 28, to do whatever your hand and your purpose predestined to occur. What you can't ever lose track of is that everything that's happening in the judgment, in the trial, ultimately in the beating, the scourging, and the crucifixion of Jesus, all of it is exactly what God foreordained and predestined to be done, because that was the methodology through which God was saving his people. So if there is a pathetic character in this story, it's Pontius Pilate, who despite himself, who though he's full of himself and full of his own authority and full of his own sense of I say who lives and I say who dies, nevertheless, the reality is he didn't have any power unless God gave him the power, and he only did exactly what God predestined he would do. Now we'll get deeper into Pontius Pilate as we go, because the writers of the Gospels tell us a fair bit about Pilate's attitude toward all of this. You got to look at the political ramifications of what was going on at this moment. He really was caught in the middle of a situation he really didn't want to be in. And yet, to this very day, 2,000 years later, we still know the name Pontius Pilate. And we still associate it with the greatest crime that ever occurred on the planet, the crucifixion of the only innocent one. Look at Acts 3:13. This is during Peter's sermon. He takes the time to say to the Jews, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of our fathers, has glorified his servant Jesus, the one whom you delivered up and disowned in the presence of Pilate when he had decided to release him. The historic record is Pilate tried to release Christ. And Peter, even preaching, says, Pilate tried to give him back to you, but you desired a murderer, you desired to have Barabbas, and you killed the Prince of Life. But no matter who you're talking about in this scenario, whether you're talking about Pilate, whether you're talking about Herod, whether you're talking about Gentiles, whether you're talking about Jews, they all did exactly what God ordained would be done. In other words, this is a very Reformed, Calvinistic, sovereign grace writing of the crucifixion of Christ. Do you understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. We are the ones, we sovereign grace Reformed folks, we are the ones who say God predestines things. God is in charge of everything. And if you take away God's absolute control over the crucifixion of Christ, then it becomes some kind of aberration where the creatures manage to capture and torture and kill the Prince of Life. But only if you look at it through the proper lens, which is the lens of God's absolute predestinary purpose and will, only then can you understand what's really happening. Ron, you had your hand up.
I'm just going to say, when it's that crystal clear, okay, how do you argue with that?
When it's that clear, how do you argue with it?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like James White said last week, you know, people will read into a text and say, well, it's not very clear. It could mean this or it could mean that.
It's funny that you bring that up, Ron. Yesterday, I recorded our first audio Q&A for our website. Something new I'm trying. Typing is a chore, and I answer a lot of people's questions. And in fact, recently, some folks who have written to me asking long, involved questions, I've just recorded an answer, made an MP3, and sent it back to them, because it's just quicker and easier. Well, I was recently sent a video by a preterist arguing that the word thousand in Revelation 20 doesn't mean actual literal thousand. And so I created a 55-minute audio response to that video yesterday, and I'm calling it 1,000 equals 1,000, because like you said, Ron, it's clear, and words mean things. And I operate on the basic assumption that if the words on the page don't mean what they say, then we have no way of knowing what they actually mean, because they have a definition. And because they have a definition, those are the words that the original writer chose to use. Chose to use the words, they were gathered together to do whatever your hand foreordained, predestined to be done. Chose those words on purpose because those words had a meaning, and that was the meaning that the original authors intended to convey. If that is not what the words mean, we have no way of knowing what the meaning is. We have no way of knowing what the original authors meant to say, because what they meant was not what they said. So I argue for what they said, and what they say has meaning.
Yeah, it's not like that's some obscure passage or something out of the Old Testament to where, you know, you are kind of left scratching your head. I mean,
it's plain, it's pretty clear.
I feel like the car is red, you know?
Exactly. And by the way, when it says the car is red, it means the little boy played in the yard. Okay. Did you enjoy that? Yeah.
It's funny, I was just, before you guys started this, I was just sitting here thinking about it. And it seems to me the biggest hurdle anyone has to go through is man's depravity. And if God doesn't show somebody that fact, they can't understand it. So you're arguing with people who are depraved and God is not enlightened. They are prevented from seeing it. They cannot see it. Just like we couldn't see it. I never saw it in 50 years. I didn't see it. Because you always start with the assumption of responsibility and, you know, I'm a bad person and I can make good decisions maybe and blah, blah, blah. But if you don't understand depravity, and you can't unless God shows you, you can't possibly make hay out of that verse. At best, you'll say, well, in this instance, yeah, God was real sovereign, extreme sovereign, but not in general, not in our lives and all activities. So you just lose it, because if you could see it, you wouldn't be depraved.
I agree. Mm-hmm. Now, verse 28. Verse 28 is really, really interesting, because it has to do with religion, and it has to do with the traditions that are attached to religion. Now, religion can sometimes be a bad word. Religion can sometimes be a good word. In the book of James, he writes about a pure and undefiled religion. Religion in and of itself is not a bad thing. Tradition in and of itself is not a bad thing, as long as you're talking about the traditions that promote the worship of Christ. We meet here at a given time twice a week. Some of you, once a week. We meet here, and that's our traditional time to meet. And that's not an inherently bad thing. But sometimes tradition can become so thick, like what Alex was just talking about, the tradition of man's capability or man's free will. Tradition all too often trumps God's word. Jesus said to the Pharisees that they made the word of God of no effect by their traditions. And so by the time Jesus was walking on the planet, the rules and the laws that had been given at Mount Sinai 1,400 years previous to that, those rules and laws had now also had a whole lot of tradition added to them, and the rules just kept growing and growing. I think I've told you before that if you go back and you read the writing of some of the Jewish rabbis through the years, some of the great rabbis, they've discussed Sabbath rules, like how far you could travel from your house on the Sabbath before you were actually breaking some of the work laws. They actually took a great deal of time to discuss whether you could eat an egg that was laid on the Sabbath. And it was determined that you could, provided the chicken didn't work. They discussed whether you needed to light a fire before the Sabbath began, because if you lit your fire during the Sabbath to cook or anything else, that was doing work. And so there were a lot of traditions that the Jews held to, and those traditions made the Word of God null and void. They were busy, as Jesus said, they were busy doing things like making sure that they gave exactly 10% of every little spice, their mint and their cumin. And he said, you're so careful to do that, and then you ignore the weightier matters of the law, things like mercy and judgment. So they were so busy keeping their traditions that they failed to understand what the Word of God was actually saying. Had they actually understood the Word of God, they would have understood who Jesus was. They would have recognized all the prophecies he was fulfilling. But because, as Alex just said, because their hearts and minds were closed and blinded by God to all these things, they were very zealous to keep their traditions and at the same time didn't recognize that they were doing some of the most heinous things that people can do. Here's an example in verse 28. They led Jesus, therefore, from Caiaphas into the praetorium, and it was early. They themselves did not enter into the praetorium in order that they might not be defiled or made ceremonially unclean so that they could eat the Passover. It is Passover, after all. They want to participate in the Passover meal. So they want to be ceremonially clean so that they can eat the Passover meal. So even though they are delivering the Prince of Life to the Romans to be killed, they made sure not to go into the court so that they could stay clean to eat the Passover. Do you understand how they kept their tradition and at the same time were doing the exact wrong thing? They thought that by keeping their religion, they were pleasing God. But in fact, what they were doing was proving that they were the enemies of the gospel, haters of Christ, and going to be directly responsible in the death of the Prince of Life. And they were going to prefer a murderer. But, hey, they were clean. So, you know, you got to give them that. Now, the New American Standard Version here says praetorium. You've probably got other translations of the building that he was in. This is actually the barracks for the guards. I told you last week that especially three times a year, whenever there was a feast in Jerusalem, that's when you would have an expansion of the amount of Roman guard that would be in the city, because you had a real high concentration and a very volatile concentration of Jews in Jerusalem. Pilate typically did not stay in Jerusalem. Pilate usually lived up in Caesarea, in a palace that Herod the Great had actually built for himself, and then the Romans took it over, and that was where the Roman procurator would usually stay. But it's a feast, and so it's one of those moments when he's got to be able to report back to Rome that everything is copacetic, good Bible word there, that everything is copacetic down in Jerusalem. So he's in Jerusalem, but he doesn't have a place to stay, so he's staying at the barracks of the Gentile Roman guards. And so when the Jews come to find him, they go as far as the outer court, but then they send Jesus in to meet with him. They stay outside. The rest of the conversation you see here then is understood in that context. It's a discussion between Pilate and Jesus, but it's a private discussion because there's a principle at work here. Isaiah 53 says, in describing Jesus, in prophesying about Jesus, that the same way that when a sheep is taken in front of his shearers, the sheep is, King James says, dumb. It doesn't mean stupid, it means he doesn't speak. That a sheep is silent when he's brought before his shearers, and he describes Jesus, Isaiah does, he describes Jesus the same way. that he's going to be silent. One of the things that historians are fascinated by, and one of the things that the Roman leaders and the Jews were really confounded by, was that Jesus fulfilled that prophecy and would not defend himself. They kept waiting for him to say something they could charge him with. But he didn't say anything. He stayed silent like a lamb before his shearers, or like a lamb being led to the slaughter. He was silent the whole time. But in front of Pilate, he has a conversation because the Jews are not there. The shearers then, the ones who are bringing him to the slaughter, are the Jews. And in front of the Jews, in front of Caiaphas, those kind of people, he's silent. Now, not only is he fulfilling prophecy by staying silent, but there's a whole other element to Jesus' silence, and it's this. With Jesus, words are things, because he is the Logos. He is the speaking agency through which everything was made. We know from Genesis that in the beginning, God said, "Let there be light." We know from the beginning of the Gospel of John that in the beginning, the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and that the Word spoke, and that things happened, and that everything that is sustained by his Word and his power. Jesus told Peter in the garden, "Put away your sword. Don't you know I could ask my Father? He would send 12 legions of angels to come down here and fight for me." All Jesus has to do is speak the Word. All he has to do is defend himself, and his defense is irrefutable, because it's the Word of God. All Jesus has to say is, "I'm innocent, and you're not about to kill me," and they will all fall down the same way they did in the garden. All he has to do is say, "You're my enemies and you're dead," and they're going to wither up and die like the fig tree did. All he has to do is speak the Word. And so he doesn't. He's silent because he has to be silent, because this has to take place, because this is what God's hand has foreordained to be done. So he places himself willingly like a sheep to the slaughter. Remember, this is the same Jesus who said, "No man takes my life from me. I have the power to lay my life down. I have the power to take it up again. I have this command from my Father." This is very, very sovereign work that's going on here. I find the conversation between Pilate and Jesus to be really fascinating, though. Verse 29. Pilate, therefore, went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" Now, you have to assume, since they already had a Roman guard that they took into the garden to go get Jesus, that they had to have at least explained something. You can't just go say, "We need a Roman guard." Why? They had to have at least explained, "Well, there's a guy, there's a treacherous guy, and we know where he is right now, and he's in the Garden of Gethsemane, and we've got a traitor, and he's going to tell us who he is, so we need to go get him." Now they bring him in front of Pilate, and Pilate says, "Okay, here he is. What's the charge? What are you charging him with?" Listen to this answer. This is very clever, twisted logic. "And they answered and said to him, 'If this man were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him up to you.'" There's my reason. That's circular logic. He's guilty. What's he guilty of? Look, if we hadn't brought him to you, he wouldn't be guilty. But we brought him to you, and that proves he's guilty. Take him, charge him. On what charge? On the charge that we brought him to you. We wouldn't have brought him to you if he wasn't guilty. And that proves he's guilty because we brought him. By the way, I know a lot of people who do their theology that way. Anyway. Pilate therefore said to them, "Well, take him yourselves and judge him according to your law." The Jews said to him, "We are not permitted to put anyone to death." See, they're not interested in proper judgment. They're only interested in him dead. That's all they really care about. They don't care about having a case. They don't care about evidence. They don't care about good witnesses. We saw last week that they were trying to find false witnesses. They're trying to get anybody that would charge him with anything. And so now they come to the Romans and say, "We just want him dead. And if we just follow our law, he's innocent. And so we're hoping you can find something against him." Now, by the way, Is it completely true when they say, you know, we don't have anything in our law that allows us to kill people? Is that exactly true?
Stoning.
Exactly. The woman caught in adultery? They do have a long history of stoning people to death. But at this moment, they've got nothing on him. And they really want to make a public example of him. And remember, here's the political importance, one of the things they did not want him to do was die on Passover. Remember the conversation? They didn't want him to die on Passover because they were afraid then that there would be a riot in Jerusalem. And then they, the Jewish leaders, would have to answer for that and they would lose their power. But they said, we can't kill him. We'll make a martyr out of him if we kill him at Passover. And then the end of this thing will be worse than the first because the people reckon him to be a prophet. So they didn't want his blood on their hands. They didn't want the responsibility because they did not want to lose their standing among the Jewish people over whom they lorded all this power and might and made themselves rich. They didn't want to lose that kind of authority. They wanted to pawn this off on Pilate. And Pilate knows it. Pilate recognizes the trick. Pilate therefore said to them, take him yourselves. Judge him according to your law. And the Jews said to him, we're not permitted to put anyone to death. And he said that so that the word of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spoke, signifying by what kind of death he was about to die. Let me explain that. As we just all agreed, Jews were not known for crucifying. They stoned people. That was their death penalty of choice. And of course, if you look back at the Levitical law and you look back at the Sinaitic law, stoning was the typical way that you would kill somebody. It's not the way Romans did it. Romans were infamous for crucifixion. Now in John 3, Jesus, talking to Nicodemus, said the same way that the serpent in the wilderness was raised up, I have to be raised up. Well, stoning doesn't raise you up. Stoning knocks you down. He said he had to be raised up. Later in the book of John, he says, I think it's in John 12, if I be lifted up, I will draw all to myself. You remember that? Three times in the book of John, he makes direct reference to the fact that he's going to be lifted up. And then he tells his apostles, if I'm lifted up, I'll be back. He takes the time to explain to them the kind of death he's going to die. That's why John points it out. He's going to die by crucifixion, and he knows it because the prophets have already prophesied it. David prophesies it. Isaiah prophesies it. He's going to have to die in a way where all his joints are pulled out of joint, where he's raised up above the people and they can look up on him. He has to die that way. And so the reason, according to John, the reason that they took him to Pilate, because remember, they're only doing what God foreordained they would do. The reason they took him to Pilate and didn't kill him themselves, even though they have a record, like the woman caught in adultery, they have a record of stoning, but they couldn't stone Jesus. Even if they wanted to, they couldn't, because that wasn't God's plan. And so he had to be lifted up. That means he has to be taken to the people who kill by lifting up. You understand me? And John caught all that and put it in the text of his gospel so that we would understand that nothing was happening by mistake. Pilate therefore said to them, take him yourselves and judge him according to your law. The Jews said to him, we're not permitted to put anyone to death, that the word of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spoke, signifying by what kind of death he was about to die. Pilate therefore entered again into the praetorium and summoned Jesus. This means now they're going away from the Jews and going inside. Remember, the Jews have to stay outside. So this is a private conversation. He summoned Jesus and he said to him, I love this question. Are you the king of the Jews? Is that a great question? Now think about Pilate's reference point for the word king. Because Pilate would love to be king, but he's not. He's a procurator. and he's been given politically an area that's just notoriously difficult to rule over. This is not where Pilate wants to be. He wants to be in Rome. He wants to be where the action is. And if you go to Rome, there's a Caesar who is not just a king, but he is worshipped as a god. And so that's his reference point for king. And now he's looking at this man in a robe and sandals, and he says, "Are you king of the Jews?" It's a real interesting question because depending on what Jesus says, there are a lot of ramifications. If he does say, "Yes, I'm the king of the Jews," that's a way of saying that the Jews are looking to establish their own kingdom separate from Rome. In that case, Pilate has a really big political problem. But if he is also king of the Jews, he is the fulfillment of prophecy. Now remember that we're talking about a Roman here, which means that he's been raised on Roman mythology. He's been raised on a pantheon of gods. He's been raised on stories of gods who cavort and have wars and have children and commit affairs, and they're lustful sort of gods. And if he is in fact the king of the Jews and the son of God, then you can see why this would make Pilate rather nervous, because his own mythology allows for the notion of there being a God-man on the planet walking around. And if he's responsible for killing him, well, there's just a whole lot of tradition and a whole lot of mythology that is playing around in Pilate's mind when he has to deal with this prophet, this man of God. So take all that into account when you think about the questions that he asks. Pilate says to him, "Are you king of the Jews?" Jesus doesn't directly answer the question. He says, "Are you saying this on your own initiative, or did someone else tell you about me?" He says, why would you even ask that question? Did someone tell you to ask that question? Or is this your own initiative? You want to know the answer to this question. And so Pilate says, "Am I a Jew?" He says, "I'm not a Jew, am I?" In other words, he's saying, "I wouldn't have known this unless they told me." Remember, he kept wanting to know, what's the charge? They did get a Roman guard. On what basis did they get a Roman guard? Remember the numbers? Between 600 and 1,000 soldiers that went to the garden? How did they get that? Well, obviously they said, there's a guy who's trying to overthrow Roman rule, and he's making himself out to be king of the Jews, and that's going to cause an insurrection against Rome, and therefore we need a lot of soldiers to go get him and quell this uprising. So at some point, Pilate's been told. He's been told this guy considers himself king of the Jews. Ironically, and we'll get to it in a couple of weeks, ironically, when Jesus was crucified, Pilate tells them to make a plate to put over the cross itself that Jesus is hanging on. Typically, on that plate, on that writing, would be the charge of the person who was hanging on the cross, so that if you saw someone on a cross, you would know what they were being crucified for. What were they guilty of? And so Pilate tells them to write, "King of the Jews," in three languages, so that everybody in the area can read it. In Greek, in Latin, in Hebrew. Everybody in the area can read, "King of the Jews." The Jews come back to Pilate and say, "No, no, 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 no. Right? He said he was the king of the Jews." Pilate says, "What I've written, I've written." I mean, Pilate's really conflicted about this guy. Pilate's really not sure what to do about him. So he says, "I am not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and your chief priests delivered you up to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, now this is in response to, "Are you a king?" He says, "My kingdom is not of this world, cosmos. If my kingdom were of this world, cosmos, then my servants would be fighting that I might be delivered up to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this," and he doesn't say cosmos. He says entheuthen, completely different Greek word. And so some of your translations will say, like the New American Standard says, not of this realm. Actually, the word, the Greek word, endeuthen, means hence, here, this locality. Now, an awful lot of bad theology has grown out of the fact that Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world. As people do with so much of the Bible, that verse is often taken from its context, not even that verse, that phrase is taken from its context and used to defend all kinds of ideas of spiritual kingdom. And they'll say, well, Jesus even said, my kingdom's not of this world. And from there, they will leap to conclusions that Jesus didn't say, that are not in the text. They'll leap to, well, Jesus said, my kingdom's not of this world, therefore his kingdom is a spiritual kingdom, therefore his kingdom is a heavenly kingdom. Therefore, when he resurrected and rose on high and sat on the right hand of God, somehow magically on David's throne, I'm not sure how David's throne got to heaven, but hey, play along with me, that when he's there, that is now the establishment of the kingdom that he was talking about, because his kingdom is not of this world. None of that is in the text. That is just people starting with a conclusion and using the text to try to prove the conclusion. But if we allow the text to say what it says, he used two words and he used them synonymously. He used cosmos, world, and we know that in the book of John, the word cosmos has a minimum of 16 different nuances and meanings. So he said, my kingdom is not of this cosmos, and then synonymously said, not of this realm, not of this hence, not of this right here. Now let's think about what that means, because he also defined it by saying, if my kingdom were of this realm, my followers would fight. Now, you're talking about a Roman court. You're talking about an area that is under Roman occupation. And at the time, the Roman Empire rules what was considered the known world. That's the realm he's talking about. How did the Romans become the Roman Empire? Fighting. Mm-hmm. Armies marching, crushing, destroying, wrecking stuff and breaking things. That's how they became an empire. Jesus says, if I were a king, I'd fight like you guys fight. If I were a king, we would take up arms and we would fight. If I were a king like you're a king. Remember I said his mindset has to do with kings like Caesar or kings like Alexander the Great, who conquered, and that's how he became king. Or kings like Nebuchadnezzar, who built and fought and conquered. The kings of this world fight. That's how they become kings. When Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world, this realm, this domain, he said, if it were, we'd be fighting. But as it is, it's not of this realm. It's a different kind of kingdom. It's a kingdom that is going to be ruled by absolute power of God that changes people. It inhabits people. It turns people. It awakens people. It moves on people's hearts. Jesus wins through grace, through power, through love, through mercy, through loving kindness, through sacrifice. That's the kind of kingdom he's talking about. And he says, my kingdom is not like the Roman kingdom. It's not of this realm. Now that's as much as we can take from that verse. We are not allowed from that verse to then leap to it's a spiritual kingdom or it's a heavenly kingdom or it's in any other kind of kingdom. He's still using the word kingdom perfectly in league with every other time that he has used the word kingdom in the book of John. And every single time, it's been a reference to the kingdom that all the Old Testament prophets have promised for Israel. But what he's saying is, when I establish my kingdom, it's not going to be of this realm. It's not going to be this kind of kingdom. You understand me? Don't let people play that one on you, because that's a popular one. Yes, sir?
I ask forgiveness if I'm wrong on this here, but as far as what's kind of ironic, that's in the end, when he does come back, he does include this world as now his new kingdom and his new heaven and his new earth, and it is by conquering God's way, by God's power, by God's mind.
You're talking about the end of the book of Revelation, Revelation 21, 22?
Back in this, and it's the final chapter where, you know, we're going through battle and say, you know, if you want war, well, let's do it my way. This is the way it was prophesied, and I tried telling you it's going to be the way that you want it to be, but just not now.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm okay with all of that because, again, when he comes back in clouds of glory. He comes back with angels. He comes back with a sharp sword out of his mouth. He doesn't need earthly armies. He doesn't need to go out and conquer nations by physical force. He does it by his holiness, by his righteous force. He also judges in righteousness. So, if I understand what you just said correctly, Revelation 21, 22, don't do any damage to what he has said here. He's making a clear distinction between the type of kingdom he's going to rule over and the type of kingdom that Pilate ruled over. Right?
Correct. And as far as that goes, I mean, me personally, I'd rather say, you know, if they knew truth, I'd say, well, I think you'd probably rather take your chances against man's army than what God's going to bring, because it's not going to be by any means.
Isn't that the truth? Yeah.
If you think it's going to be like tanks and grenades and stuff like that, you are sorely mistaken.
Exactly. They go to the extent, it says, that when Christ returns, they run for the rocks and the caves and the dens of the earth, and they cry to the rocks and say, fall on me and hide me from the wrath of the Lamb. Yeah, take your chances with a Roman army, because you could hide in a cave and avoid a Roman army. But there's no hiding from him when he comes back. So you can see the many ways in which he could say, my kingdom's not like your kingdom. Are you the king of the Jews? Here's what I'll tell you. My kingdom is not like this kingdom. I'm talking the kingdom that's been prophesied for hundreds and thousands of years. That kingdom won't be like this kingdom. That's his answer. Verse 37 then. Pilate understands him well enough and says to him, so you are a king. Because he's talked about my kingdom. My kingdom's not of this realm. So Pilate draws the natural conclusion and says, so you are a king? Jesus answered and said, you say correctly, correctly in this translation is an additional word from the translators. What he really said in the Greek is, you said it. So you are a king? You said it. You say correctly that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. Does that sound familiar?
John 6.
Talking about his sheep. My sheep hear my voice. They don't hear a stranger's voice. They won't follow after a stranger. My sheep hear my voice. Now he went beyond that and said, everybody who's of the truth. Think about that phrase for a moment. Everybody who's of the truth hears me. Christ is very, very exclusive. One of the things that we have to deal with as Christians is that we will be accused of being very narrow-minded. And they'll say, you know, you could get along a whole lot better if you would just adhere to the notion that there's many pathways to God and that there are many truths and they're all equal and that there's no one truth that can be said to be exclusive. The world knows a lot of truths and, you know, you just need to expand your thinking, Samuel. You just need to expand your thinking to embrace all the different ideas and philosophies and theologies that are out there in the world. And then you can get along better with the world and we can all just hold hands and sing Kumbaya. And that'll just happen if you'll all admit that there are many truths. Christianity doesn't allow for that. Jesus doesn't allow for that. Instead, he makes himself the central point in all the world, in all religion, in all eternity. He places himself once again at the center of everything and says, if you're true, if you are of the truth, you'll hear me. Have you ever tried to tell people things that Jesus has said? Like, Alex just referenced John 6. Have you ever tried to go through John 6 with somebody? And they say, I can't follow that. I don't get that. It can't say that. I don't agree with that. Well, if they were of the truth, they'd hear the truth. I didn't say it. He did. And by the way, if you don't hear him, what can you logically deduce from this verse? You're not of the truth. You may be really smart. You might be a great dancer and fun at parties. You might have a lot of degrees hanging on your wall. You might have a lot of ways that you can convince people that you're a really smart person who's on top of the facts and details of a lot of different subjects. But you're not of the truth if you don't hear Christ. And if you are of the truth, you will hear him. I didn't say it. He did. We have a lot of leaders in the world today. We have a lot of scientists in the world today telling us what they perceive the truth to be. Like global warming. Don't all laugh at once. Like Darwinism. They'll tell you, that's the truth, that's the truth. We believe we've got some kind of sketchy evidence for this. Therefore, this is the truth. What do you think of Christ? So Christ, well, we got no room for Christ in Darwinism. And yet you claim that Darwinism is the truth, and you're force-feeding it to our children in school, and you're saying that if we want to teach that the universe actually has a pattern and a wisdom to it that proves a creator, we're not allowed to say that. Can't say that. But the truth is that people all graduated from the primordial ooze and then walked up on the planet and became kangaroos and slugs and Anna. And that it just worked that way randomly through random mutation, and that's the truth. Is it?
No.
No, because it denies Christ. It denies the Creator. And Christ said, everyone who's of the truth hears me. You understand me? If you're going to be biblical, then you got to pay attention to every word and say, Jesus said it, I got to stand on it. I am a king. For this I have been born, for this I've come into the world to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. Pilate then said to him, what is truth? And that's the end of their conversation. Yeah, now, there are many different ways to read that. And depending on how the actor is directed in the film, you'll hear a lot of different readings of that. Sometimes it's Pilate being flustered and walking away like, what is truth? Sometimes it's, I don't know if that, what was it, like a Cagney I did there. I don't know what that was. And sometimes it's a philosophical question. Sometimes he says, everyone that's of the truth hears me, and he thinks about it and says, what is truth, like he cares. Sometimes, and I think this is the right one, sometimes it's just dismissive. Because at this moment, Pilate realizes he's in the middle of an argument about philosophy between Jesus and the Jews. And they want him killed over nothing more than a philosophical difference. And he doesn't want to be in this. And so he walks away going, truth? This is about truth? They've brought you here and they want you dead because you disagree on what the truth is? What is truth? And walks away. Pilate said to him, what is truth? And when he had said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, I find no guilt in him. There's nothing wrong with him. But, remember we read in the book of Acts that Peter said, Pilate tried to give him back to you. Here's where that happens. Pilate comes up with a little plan here. It's a good plan. He says, but you have a custom that I should release someone for you at the Passover. This is something that Pilate did in order to keep peace with the Jewish leaders and to make the rest of the Jewish populace feel that he was a beneficent kind of leader. And, you know, overall, though he was a Roman, not a bad guy. Because every Passover, he would give them somebody who the Romans had arrested. And so he says, it's my custom that I release someone for you at the Passover. Do you wish that I release for you the King of the Jews? He thinks this is a perfect solution. You brought him to me for judgment. I'll do the judgment thing. That should satisfy you. I'm even willing to scourge him, beat him, so he won't do that again. And then, because it's Passover, we'll release him. Everybody's happy. In Pilate's thinking, this is the perfect solution for everything, but God foreordained and predestined that he had to be lifted up. He was going to die no matter what. No matter the schemes of men, no matter their attempts to get him free, no matter what anybody tried to do, he was going to die on a cross. Before this day was over, here Pilate's trying to get him released. There's a rush to judgment, and by 3 p.m, he's hanging on a cross. It's inexplicable, and yet unavoidable, because this is what God foreordained to be done. So the chapter ties up. Therefore, they cried out again, saying, "Not this man, but Barabbas." And then John says, now Barabbas was a robber. He's a thief. He's a seditionist. He's a problem. But here's a really interesting thing. We all know that Barabbas was the person who went free because Jesus died in his place. We all know that, right? Okay. What does that word mean? And it is not a singing group from Switzerland or wherever they're from. Yeah, it's the word Abba, it's Father. You know that because Paul writes that we can come to the throne of grace crying, Abba, Father. Now, when you're talking about someone being the son of somebody in the Hebrew language, you may know the name Simon Bar-Jonah. Have you heard that? That means Simon, son of Jonah. Bar means son of. The same way that among us Irish guys, Mick means son of. Mick Clarty. So Bar Abba means son of the father. Plural.
Oh my gosh.
Jesus died. The sons of the father went free. Wow. It wasn't a guy named Clyde that Pilate offered. It wasn't a guy named Dave or Doug or Ralph or Simon. It just happened to be that there was a guy there at that exact moment whose name was Barabbas. At that moment, wasn't that lucky? That his parents, all those years before, happened to name him that? And that he just happened to be a bad guy. And he just happened to be arrested in Jerusalem at that moment. And Pilate just happened to know about him. And that he was there and that he was available. And he offers him to the Jews. And says, look, you can have Jesus, you can have Barabbas. And they say, kill him, Jesus, and let him go free. And we've been going free ever since, haven't we? We've been deserving to die over and over again ever since that moment. Mm-hmm. And we keep going free because we had a substitute who died in our place. Look, the same story's just being told over and over and over again, even in the details. Mm-hmm. He's in control, friends. He's in absolute control of absolutely everything that is happening in his death, because this is the plan that he and the Father made before the foundation of the world. So when you watch those Hollywood movies, just don't watch those Hollywood movies. Just pay attention to what your Bible says and get your image of Christ from there. You're talking about an absolute sovereign who laid his life down so that you could go free. And that is really good news.
On behalf of everyone at Grace Christian Assembly, we thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. Remember to visit us on the internet at www.salvationbygrace.org. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.